Hey everybody, welcome back to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. This is Dr. Josh Yellen, Program Director of the University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program, filling in for Jeremy Jackson. Let's go to the table and introduce ourselves. To my left is
Will Ryan,
Nicole Kasha,
Mike Greaser,
Daniel Young,
Jasmine Jones.
So we're going to be here and we're going to ask you some questions about pertaining to your area. Will, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Obviously, you talked a lot about the foot and ankle. We talked about Jones fractures, metatarsal fractures. One of the questions I have, so with a Jones fracture, obviously, most of that stress is on the lateral side of the foot. Now, if you are let's take a basketball player, for example, and you excessively supinate, most of that stress is going to be on the fifth metatarsal. So what I've learned about, you know, pronation and supination is if there's no symptoms, then we don't need to correct the problem. However, if we're trying to prevent a Jones fracture, should you use a heel wedge or?
Right. So I think that is a major issue, especially with these players who have their first Jones fracture, or then especially the players who have a recurrent injury. So whether it be Jones fractures treated non-op and then fractures again, or we even see these break around the screw. So if there is an underlying foot deformity, or lateral column, if there's too much stress on the lateral column of the foot, which would be associated with a cavus or high arch or over-supinated foot, I think it's extremely important to try to correct that alignment, either if it's a flexible deformity, try to correct it with a heel wedge or a custom orthotic with a heel wedge built into it. I think that's definitely appropriate.
That's a great question, Will. Nicole, you have a question for Dr. Greaser?
Yes, I have a question. One of the things that you mentioned in presentation was bracing and taping and how it's more of a psychological aspect. How much of an advocate are you on presenting that and showing that and educating athletic trainers and players about taping and bracing?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, there is certainly a role for taping and for bracing, for that matter. But I think that there are some studies out there that show that the stabilizing effects of tape wear off pretty quickly, usually within the first 5 minutes of play. So, you know, I think that kind of plays to the fact that this is probably more of a psychological treatment than it is a stabilizing treatment for the ankle. And I think, you know, a lot of returning to play is psychology and sports psychology, right? Whether you are trusting of the ankle and are able to use it without thinking about it, right? Or at least being able to trust it. And I think that for that matter, the brace and a taping is certainly useful. So,
Dr. Greaser, can I interrupt you here for a second? So going back to the taping aspect, right, I totally agree. I think the research says that once you tape an ankle, the medicinal effects would wear off in about 20 minutes. And now you're really working off the proprioceptive aspect. So go back to some of the questions that Will and Nicole just asked you and address some of the, I don't know, some of your ideas and some of the latest themes and the evidence that addresses, you know, how much balance, how much proprioception, how much core, you know, how much of that is important in, you know, dealing with the foot and ankle.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's extremely important. And part of the way that we prevent these injuries is going to be to regain our full strength and proprioception. And I think that's probably the most important aspect of returning these people to play without putting them at risk of recurrent injury. So there's no doubt that rehab is of utmost importance here, and getting the strength and proprioception back to a symmetric level with the uninjured side is really our goal before we return these people to sport.
And so along those lines, right, foot is, I would look at foot and hand very similar, right?
Yeah.
You have a dominant side and a non-dominant side, and that dominance really kind of exacerbates itself when you're dealing with foot and hand. And so tell the audience a little bit about your return to play protocol. What are some benchmarks that you're looking at? So, you know, Will is, the athletic trainer that's working with you, and the two of you are having a conversation. You say, hey, Will, I'm not comfortable with this person going back until I see what?
Right. So, and, you know, I think that is probably one of the areas where we're majorly lacking is in our ability to have a validated way to return people to play, because we don't really have that yet. And, you know, the way that I determine how to return people to play is by their strength and whether they can, mostly eversion and plantar flexion. We want to make sure that their dynamic stabilizers or their perineal muscles that are going to evert the foot are able to help to compensate for any ligamentous laxity that may have occurred with the injury. So I think your eversion strength should be symmetric with the contralateral side. In addition, you know, there are some have advocated the single limb hop test. I don't think there's any necessarily proof that it's a good measure, but if a player can hop on one leg without pain, it usually means that they have some amount of proprioception and strength. Otherwise, they won't be able to do that. Now, you know, whether that's the right way to go about it, I don't know, and I think we have a lot of work to do in this field to really come up with some validated measures to return these people to play and prevent injury.
So you had just mentioned the plantar flexion and eversion, which you're really addressing the pronis longus, pronis brevis, right?
Correct.
And so when I was coming through school, there was a lot of emphasis that was placed on that tibialis anterior, where you really want them to be looking at dorsiflexion. But you're saying eversion and plantar flexion. So if you have an athletic trainer that's performing rehab, it sounds like the majority of that focus needs to be on pain reduction, range of motion, but really emphasize those perineals, whereas before, maybe 10, 20 years ago, it was emphasized tibialis anterior, emphasize circumduction, all that other stuff.
Right.
It's really more focused now towards...
Well, I think the anterior tib is certainly important, too. I mean, most of this is just regaining motion without stretching the ligaments that are injured. And any time we have an injury to those ligaments, it involves a tear in the joint capsule, which then causes bleeding into that joint. And if we're going to return an athlete to play, they really need to have a full range of motion. And that's tough to do because as soon as we bleed into our joint, that's just nidus for scar tissue, right? So these people get stiff quickly and everybody responds differently. And it's been, you know, there's a wide variability in the way athletes respond to that sort of stress. So.
Sure. Dan, you have a question? Dr. Pearson?
Question and comment, actually.
Okay.
So when I came out of grad school, I read an article that was provided, and I have been unable to find it in my resources. But the article was on the differences between taping and bracing.
Mm-hmm.
And taping side said everything that everybody else has hit on. It lasts 20, 30 minutes on a good day. Doesn't really do a lot structurally, doesn't last. You get a lingering proprioceptive feedback, and the better side of that would be a brace, and not the general lace-up brace, like a you want the lace-up figure eight wrap, something that you could adjust during a game.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in a brace, whether or not it helps you structurally, it gives your body an increased reaction time.
Mm.
So you stimulate your mechanoreceptors, and that in and of itself is preventing a sprain, regardless of how much actual support the brace gives you. So would that make sense? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly do think that there is some external feedback from bracing or taping, for that matter, that, you know, beyond the psychological effect, there is some external feedback that you get from these braces that help us maybe even subconsciously to realize what position in space our ankle is or to help with that proprioception. So I think that there's no doubt that also plays a role in preventing some of these recurrence.
Is one more weighty than the other, psychological versus...
I don't know if we know the answer to that question, honestly. I think that, you know, certainly, and it may be different for each player. You know, some players are better copers than others and don't think about re-injuring themselves, and others there's a huge emphasis on whether they are going to re-injure themselves when they go back. So,
So in going back to injury prevention, other than looking at like the landing, running, jumping mechanics of an athlete, and also, you know, the structural integrity of the athlete's foot, are there any, you know, functional tests or screening measures that can be utilized before the season starts that help you identify which athletes are going to be at risk for, you know, bone injuries, ankle sprains, you know, et cetera?
As far as ankle sprains, I'm not aware of any that have been, you know, validated. I think, you know, after injury, there is some, there's been some attempt to validate some different ways of showing these athletes have full strength or their agility's return. But I don't, you know, I don't know if anything's been validated as from a preventative standpoint. So
there's no, of all the different things I've heard,
yeah,
there's nothing that's been studied.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have different suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
Like lack of dorsiflexion.
Lack of dorsiflexion, flat foot versus high foot.
Yeah.
Just general biomechanics.
Mostly anecdotal.
Yeah. About the best one, the easiest one is just a squat test.
Mm-hmm.
If you can have somebody do a squat, you can look at how their feet position on the ground. You can look at their knees dip in.
Right.
You can look at that glute gives out way too early, and that's what you're looking at, but it actually hasn't been tested and proven yet.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question that seems somewhat intuitive to me, but I'm not sure. So going back to the navicular part of your presentation, I was thinking about how the tibialis posterior is one of the insertions onto the navicular.
Mm-hmm.
So learning about when you're running and you have shin splints, it could possibly be because of the tibialis posterior. Do you think having maybe a navicular stress fracture or stress reaction could cause a secondary sort of shin splint? Have you seen that? Or
I haven't necessarily heard of that. Usually the area of the tarsonavicular that breaks is either in the central portion of the body or on the lateral third of the bone. So, you know, the tibialis posterior is inserting on the tuberosity portion, and I know that there is some association between the posterior tib and the shin splints. There's no doubt that that can be a problem, and I think that's helped with an arch support in some cases. But as far as navicular stress fractures and their association with shin splints, I'm not aware of any association there.
So go back to something you just brought up. You know, when I was coming through, there was this, you know, it was like chondromalacia patella, you know.
Yeah.
Is it chondromalacia patella? Is it patellofemoral stress syndrome? And so you brought up tibialis posterior, and that brings up medial tibial stress syndrome.
Right.
So talk about, you know, that total category. Nicole just brought up shin splints, and shin splints is really a catch-all term
mm-hmm.
for anything that happens in the lower shank. So talk about tibialis posterior, medial tibial stress syndrome, the interaction of the foot, navicular drop.
Yeah.
You know, how often do you use Festline? How, you know, what are some of the steps that you're using?
Right. So for tibialis posterior or posterior tib problems, I don't necessarily see a lot of these in athletes. I think these are typically, at least not in young athletes. I think it's more the weekend warrior where I see these injuries or these problems with the posterior tib. And they normally present saying, I've got ankle pain. And right away, you know, when you have them point to the spot, it's pretty apparent that this is not necessarily an ankle joint problem. This is a posterior tib problem.
Where is that spot?
So usually they're pointing right inferior to the medial malleolus along the lines of the posterior tib. So if you could, you can usually palpate the tuberosity of the tarsonavicular and the medial malleolus. And normally they're going to, that's exactly where that posterior tib runs, and you're going to palpate right there, and that's where they're going to hurt. And they're going to, you know, some of the other ways that we can see if they're having pain is if they have pain with either a double limb or especially with a single limb heel rise, they'll usually localize their pain or they'll be unable to perform those tests if they have.
So if it's single leg, that gastrocnemius won't be strong enough to overcome.
It can't. So in order for you to do a single limb heel rise, you have to be able to lock the transverse tarsal joints, and that's a function of the posterior tib tendon. So if your posterior tib is not functioning, you won't be able to lock your transverse tarsal joints, and your midfoot will be too flexible to perform a single limb heel rise. So
you just won't be able to do it.
Can't
so
do
you're
it,
really
yeah.
talking about, you know, that tarsal tunnel, that posterior tib is coming right off that medial malleolus and that tubercle.
Yeah.
So, you know, talking to some of our, you know, graduate students, right, they're in their second year.
Sure.
Talk a little bit about your physical examination. You know, they've learned in class, you know, Tom, Dick, and nervous area, right?
Yeah.
Tibia. Everybody that understands.
Right.
So talk about that clinical examination, and can you walk us through step by step, you know, when you're looking at a foot,
sure.
what's that process like for you?
So I think, you know, the most important thing for me, especially really when I examine any foot, is you have to get them off the table. I think, you know, when you're examining the foot, so much of this is weight bearing, right? So if you, because when you're sitting on a table, your foot will take on a completely different position than when you're standing. So I always have, the first thing I have people do is stand up, show them, look at their foot alignment when they're standing, see if you can see any asymmetry. If there is any question of asymmetry, I'll have them turn around, I'll look at their heels from behind. You can see if their heels in varus or valgus or neutral, or if it's just different from the other side. Because a lot of these people may have congenital flat feet, and if as long as both sides are the same, I don't get worried about it, right? And then from there, I usually will have people, if there's a concern for a posterior tib problem, then I'll have them do a single and double limb heel rise. If they can't do that, that's a pretty telltale sign that there's an issue with their posterior tib tendon. In addition, if they're complaining of anterior ankle pain, one of the best things you can have them do is to do a single and double limb heel squat, or a single or double limb squat. The double limb squat will really localize that anterior medial impingement, and I found that more commonly if you have them squat on one leg, that'll bring out that anterior lateral impingement, which isn't necessarily as common. But we see that a lot, especially in football players, and specifically in especially the defensive guys like linebackers. We see a lot of anterior ankle impingement, so that's helpful.
And why, go back to linebacker. Why you know, linebacker? I would imagine maybe in linemen.
Yeah,
linebackers. I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah, and I don't know what the cause is, but it was
because they're always on that forefoot, kind of leaning.
They're always sort of in that stance, that sort of squatted stance, ready to fire in whatever direction they're moving. And I don't know if that's the reason why, but and this is just anecdotal. I've seen it a lot in these linebackers. So
it seems like an interesting case study, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where was that? So I think, you know, as far as an exam, the functional exam is extremely important. So having them stand up, do these maneuvers, you've got to do that. And then the seated exam is basically just, you know, testing their strength, their range of motion. I always look at their gastroc. So, you know, if they are unable to get to neutral with their knee extended, then I get pretty worried that they've got a gastrocnemius contracture, which in my mind can cause a lot of different problems with the foot and ankle. So I always test their dorsiflexion range of motion with the knee extended and the knee flexed, and it's incredible the number of people that have a gastrocnemius contracture, whether it's symptomatic or not. So beyond that, it's, you know, just palpating the ankle, figuring out where the tenderness is, looking at areas of swelling, and knowing your anatomy, right?
Yeah, you need to make sure that you know your anatomy. So let's bring up, as you're in that area, let's bring up the plantaris. So, right, we know on cadaver dissection, not everybody has a plantaris.
Sure.
It's about the same ratio that people have with palmaris longus. You know, I think it's like 35% of people
right.
don't have it. So in your clinical examination, plantaris really doesn't play a role, but in a surgical intervention, tell us, you know, where does that plantaris come into play? How does it come into play? Why does it come into play? What does it do? Do we even need it anymore?
Yeah.
Should we just do away with it?
I'm really not. I mean, other than in cases of chronic Achilles tendon rupture, I don't really pay much attention to the plantaris. I think that it can rupture, and I've seen people who have a suspected plantaris rupture that kind of presents as a calf strain or sprain, you may say. But other than that, I think that the plantaris really doesn't play a whole lot of role. We used to harvest it for tendon graft, but these days with allograft, and there's just better ways of getting tissue if we're looking to reconstruct tendons and
so
ligaments.
What does a plantaris rupture look like? How would it present? You know, like the probably one of the more unique cases I ever saw was a popliteus issue.
Yeah.
But it only happened in runners. You know,
right.
Sprinters. So tell, I mean, what does a plantaris issue look like? Give us a history.
Usually the patient will present reporting that they've had a pop, and then they'll present with calf pain. And it's always difficult, and I don't necessarily think you can localize that rupture to the plantaris unless you get an MRI, because there's so many. I mean, you could tear the muscle belly of the gastroc at its confluence. You can tear the medial or lateral head of the gastroc. So I think for that reason, it's really hard to tell if they've just torn their plantaris unless you have an MRI to confirm that diagnosis. The main thing is you want to confirm that they don't have an Achilles tendon rupture, and that's pretty easily done with the Thompson test, which you guys are probably familiar with. I usually have these people lay prone on the table, look at the resting plantar flexion of both sides, the injured side and the uninjured side, and then just do a quick Thompson's test. And in my experience, there's very few partial ruptures of the Achilles, if any. I'd say zero in my practice. Partial ruptures.
It's like Pat Riley said.
It's all.
There's no gray area. It's either black or white, right? You're either in, you're out. It's either torn or not.
Yeah. As far as
pregnant or not.
Exactly. Exactly. I find that almost all people that are referred to me for partial ruptures of their Achilles based on an MRI have complete ruptures. And the way you can tell that is just a simple physical exam, right? I mean, if you don't have any plantar flexion with the Thompson test, then you have no continuity in that tendon.
Would a plantaris rupture, would it mimic thrombophlebitis? Would it be that kind of pain? You know, so somebody comes to, you know, one of us in the clinic and says, God, you know, I've got this mid-calf pain. I feel like it's just not going away. And, you know, you're testing him and you hit that squeeze. I would imagine they'd be painful in the middle of that calf. And that's the first thing that I would think of. Uh-oh.
Would it swell?
It can. Yeah, you can have some swelling and bruising. But I don't. It's really.
The likelihood of this happening is between small and none.
Yeah.
You know, it's a zebra.
Exactly, it's a zebra. Yeah, it's a zebra.
Zebras are fun to talk about.
Yeah, zebras are fun.
Yeah. All right, so kind of along the same lines.
Yeah.
Whether it's plantaris or like that little popliteus muscle behind the knee.
Yeah.
Even the peroneus tertius.
Yeah, tertius, we don't get it. It's third.
Just cut it out at birth.
Which. Yeah. Okay, I had a cross country kid with a popliteus strain.
Yeah.
As diagnosed by a chiropractor.
Track and field.
And and I've seen a lot of tertius injuries with basketball players, just because they have the marked
the way they
You know, down the front of the fibula.
Hmm.
Is there a good way to test for, like, plantaris? There's really no good way to test for.
Yeah.
Is there a good isolation test for tertius or popliteus?
Popliteus, I would imagine, is that last little bit of screw home, but you can't.
Yeah, I don't know if you can.
You can't isolate that from a ligamentous issue. And the tertius, the brevis and longus. Oh, I'm gonna
imagine you're the expert. Because the tertius dorsiflexes and everts, whereas the brevis plantar flexes and everts, correct?
Right.
So I guess
I think you're going to have a really hard time
isolating
that.
Yeah.
And whether it even matters, I don't know. Right.
Okay.
I mean, but yeah, it's going to be pretty tough to isolate that on a physical exam.
I think it's like ego, you know, like you diagnose the MRI. Right.
Yeah. If you're, yeah, you're doing much better than most physicians if you're at that point. So.
All right. So a little more back on topic. Okay. So you hit on the end spot.
Yes.
Never heard of the end spot. But, like, I heard of. If you have a tarsal navicular stress fracture, it's going to hurt medially. You can
Right.
hit the medial aspect, it'll light them up, and that's it. But I've never heard of the end spot.
Right. So the end spot's been described, and it's, you know, it basically is that you palpate directly over the central third of that tarsal navicular, and they have point tenderness there. And I can't, you know, I've treated several of these since I've been in practice this year, and it's pretty incredible. The story is always the same. They come in complaining of ankle pain, and they may have had a remote ankle sprain, and usually these patients show up pretty late to me, and it's unfortunate because when they show up late, the options are sometimes not as great. But if if you're cognizant about, sort of differentiating out that ankle pain, especially if this is, because these are chronic issues, and these people will go out and they'll play, and every time they play, they'll have pain because they're stressing that navicular. And ankle sprains shouldn't be that way. Ankle sprains usually resolve, especially the mild ones, usually resolve. These players get back to playing, and they don't really have a lot of complaints usually, the majority of them. So I think if you really examine these people with the tarsal navicular stress fractures, and you press right over, you can press the front of the ankle, doesn't hurt at all. You press right over that central third of the navicular bone, and they'll jump, and that's a surefire way to know that this is more than an ankle problem. This is actually a midfoot problem, and needs to be seen by someone.
Is it prevalent in distance runners, or is it?
It's pretty. It's interesting because I think it's across all sports. I mean, we see it in basketball players. I'm pretty sure this is what ended Frank Thomas, the big hitter's career. So baseball, which we don't normally see a whole lot of foot and ankle injuries in baseball, right? Definitely in distance runners and those type of athletes where they pound that bone.
So could you talk about the talus for a little bit? So you mentioned anterior impingement. Mm-hmm. So if I have a unstable talus and it's translating anteriorly, not only am I going to lose dorsiflexion, but I might be in that impinged position. So what are some of the ways that you can, keep that talus stabilized,
right,
and prevent it from?
So I think ankle instability is we don't, there's lots of different reports. So some literature says that it's only 10% of ankle sprains. Other literature will report it as high as 50%. I think it's probably somewhere in between, and sometimes that instability really doesn't bear its ugly head unless these athletes continue to be active at a very high level, right? Because a lot of day-to-day exercisers have some underlying instability that doesn't really affect their ability to exercise or do their daily activities. So I think, that ankle instability or that increased subluxation of the talus, especially with the anterior drawer, is most effectively treated with proper rehabilitation. You have to stabilize the ankle joint with the dynamic stabilizers, whether that be the perineal muscles are by far the most important there. And then beyond that, I mean, there's sometimes not a lot you can do. And some people are just copers, and they go on and they play their sports and don't have any trouble. And honestly, a lot of times, or at least one of the theories of these big anterior bony impingement lesions is that this is your body's reaction to ankle instability. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people, and I think Anderson and the guys in Charlotte that I trained with were big believers in this, is that a lot of these athletes that would come in with anterior large bony osteophytes, either on the dorsal aspect of the talus or the anterior distal tibia, a lot of these guys their body was reacting to this instability by basically arthritis.
If they can
stiffen up the ankle, if your body can stiffen itself up by producing these osteophytes, which then limit motion, then that's the way that's the way your body does it, right? So I think whereas I think sometimes we used to just treat these anterior impingement lesions with, going in there, let's just take out the bones, that's it, and close up the ankle. A lot of times now, in order to prevent those from recurring, I think it's really necessary to, first of all, ask the patient if you had multiple ankle sprains. That should automatically send up red flags. This patient had probably previous ankle instability, even though they don't have much right now. And as soon as you take off those lesions, you'll notice that there is quite a bit of instability of the ankle. So I think you really have to treat the instability and the impingement lesions in the same setting.
Interesting. So I have a question for you, right? Going back to some runners, I saw it. I want to know your thought on this, prevalence of it. Subluxated cuboid. Right? Yeah, right. Okay.
Sounds like a chiropractor thing.
Yeah, well, you know what's funny about it is that it's not a chiropractor thing. It was a podiatrist thing. And so it was one of those things where we were dealing with some runners, and you know, these runners kept coming back, and they were having some instability directly with the cuboid, and you know, it just didn't make sense to me. And I spoke to some of my professors of mine in the athletic training school, and I was like, really? Yeah. So, you know, what's your thought process on this? And do you feel like it exists? And if it doesn't exist, then where does it come from?
I haven't necessarily heard of a subluxated cuboid. Now, I think that, you know, the cuboid can appear to be subluxed if you have a foot position that's not neutral, right? I mean, anytime we have a flat foot or a cavus foot, you either your transverse tarsal joint or the articulation between the talus navicular and calcaneus and cuboid will take on a different position, right? So potentially we're referring to a subluxated cuboid as more of a pes plana valgus type situation where they're overpronators and maybe need to have an arch support if their foot is flexible. And I don't really know what the significance of that is. And honestly, the significance of these different foot positions is up for question too. I mean, if you examine, you know, the guys who are playing at a very high level in the NFL, I mean, probably 50% of these guys have horrible flat feet and bunions, and they're not having any trouble at all. So I think that we sometimes make a big deal about the position or the alignment of your foot when, you know, I don't necessarily think it's a big deal unless it's causing them pain. You know.
So for that average person, right, go back to the weekend warrior, they're looking, you know, they're having some foot pain. They think they probably need, you know, a new pair of shoes. They've maybe been examined by their athletic trainer, referred to the physician. Give us some tidbits that we can close out on here about, you know, what are you looking for as the orthopedic surgeon? What are some of your recommendations? What are some key factors for, you know, currently practicing athletic trainers and those that are up and coming?
Looking at
shoes, looking at footwear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I see a lot of runners. I think runners are tough because they're the kind of athlete that just don't want to stop, and you're never going to convince them to stop running. And you don't want them to. I mean, you want them to be able to continue at a high level doing the activity they love. So I think you have to be, first of all, as far as footwear, I think you have to be in they need to be in a shoe that can accommodate their foot. So it has to be the right size. I think a lot of runners run in shoes that are too small or too narrow, and that can lead to problems. If they are having trouble and they don't have a neutral foot position, then I think an orthotic can be helpful to help stabilize their foot, whether it be an arch support for a patient who has pes planus or a lateral heel wedge for someone who's an oversupinator that's putting a lot of pressure on the lateral board of their foot. I think that those things can both be helpful. I see a lot of neuromas or neuritis in runners, and my first line of treatment for those patients is always a metatarsal support or metatarsal pad, and I usually will just send them to get a full-length orthotic with a metatarsal support, which there's a lot of over-the-counter options these days with built-in metatarsal supports. The problem with giving these people a metatarsal pad is if you don't put it in the right spot, you make the problem worse.
Right.
And I've gone to not giving them metatarsal pads anymore, but just sending them for a full-length orthotic with a metatarsal support built into it. And I think a lot of people have good results with that. And it sometimes fixes their problem completely.
Well, Dr. Greaser, I know that you probably need to get back to clinic and go see some patients. And
yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Any last questions for Dr. Greaser before we break here. I think our next will be Dr. Mark Knobloch, our clinical coordinator at the University of Houston Master Math and Training Program. He's going to be interviewing.
www.aha.uh.edu/MAT.
Look us up. You can look at what is an athletic trainer, our mission, vision, and goals, curriculum, all this stuff. So Dr. Knobloch could be interviewing cardiology. Dr. Greaser, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Will, Nicole,
thank you, Dr.
Thank you very much for all your.